You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Dr. Auma Obama grew up in a remote village in Kenya and lived for many years in Europe. In her memoir, And Then Life Happened, she shares her life experiences, which span cultures and languages, from her Kenyan childhood to university in Germany to her half-brother's primary campaign in Iowa. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased and honored to welcome Auma Obama to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
You say that in the Luo tradition, family structure is important, and important to your story. Can you tell us about how that is?
Family structure is very important. I'll give you an example. For example, this is in the media. Very often people are referring to me as Barack Obama's half-sister. And I often try to explain and say, in our culture, we don't have the concept of the half-brother or sister. You are all brothers and sisters. We are all family. And in part, that comes also from the fact that we had the tradition of families where there were more than one wife, and you didn't separate one sibling from another because you were all siblings. So that makes this concept of being family, being part of a bigger whole, much, much stronger.
Well, and in your family's case, where your father had a number of different wives, both simultaneously and separately.
Not at all. This is the misconception with my father in particular, because he actually married one wife after the other. He had the European concept.
He was a serial
Western
marrier.
No, he wasn't. I mean, if you look at the culture here, people have several divorces behind them, have several wives. So my father and my mother separated. He married Barack's mother and they divorced. And then he married my stepmom, who I grew up with, Ruth. So it wasn't a serial. I mean, I think this is the highlighting of it, because of my brother being in the public eye, it seems so unusual, but my father was just, a regular, normal guy and pretty Western in many ways. So the whole concept that we have traditionally, he actually wasn't adhering to that.
What was your childhood like?
My childhood was very colorful, if you want, because I grew up initially in the rural area where I was born, and then moved at a very young age to the city, to the urban area, where I was living with a new mom, my stepmom, who was a white woman. And I always say probably, and I don't remember, but, she was probably the first white person I really had contact with. And then, she was my mom. I called her mommy. And then going on from there, I went to in Nairobi as it is, we're very mixed culturally because we have different ethnic groups living in Nairobi with over 40 different languages. So it was always a culture where there was a lot of diversity, a lot of different types of people. So it was never felt that being different was something special.
But you went to an elite all-girls school, a boarding school.
I went to a boarding school, yes. And at the time, in fact, the school is interesting because originally it was called European Girls' School during the colonial period, and it was only for white girls. So after the colonial period, then they started letting African girls go to the school. And I went at a time when there were very few Europeans and very few Asians left, but the customs and the traditions were still very British. So I went to a school where, we weren't allowed to braid our hair. We had to be very proper, speak English and all of that. So, yes, I went to a school that was really great educationally.
So even though you grew up in speaking Luo,
yes,
English is really the dominant language in your life. But then you decided to study German.
I know. Everybody asked me about that. Yeah, it was a bit unusual because we had French at our school, but I didn't pay enough attention for the French. So when the opportunity came to learn German, I thought, well, it's always good to have a foreign language. And at the time, I'd been reading German literature a lot in English. And I was happy to try German as a language, and I really enjoyed it because I first of all, for the literature, and also just because German is a very down-to-earth language, and it's very much a language where the Germans don't shy away from being very direct, speaking their minds, very practical, and it speaks to who I am because I'm really quite down-to-earth and very direct, and it was really easy to kind of understand and maneuver the culture.
Well, how different is Luo from these languages?
Luo is quite different, and
I mean German, the verb seems to always be at the end of the sentence,
yeah.
But otherwise it's similar in many ways to English.
Yeah.
Luo structured totally differently.
It's totally different, and even with German, there are many words in German that you can actually, if you change a few letters, it sounds like the English. But with Luo, it's a completely different language. And to be honest, when I speak Luo, when I speak it mainly with my family, with my grandmother, I actually have to go into a different mindset. But I think it happens for every language. But in particular with Luo, it's a different mindset because culturally you're dealing with different things. things when you're speaking Luo. So it's interesting. I'm always hopping from one. I always say it's like a sea. If you go into the sea, especially the Indian Ocean, you go through warm, cold currents, and that's kind of the norm in my life.
But in the school, of course, the girls were coming from all over Kenya. Yes. That's different tribal groups, different languages. So English became the language.
It was.
Now, this was, as I said, an elite school. It cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Are there good government-funded schools, or do you have to go to a school like that if you want to get a decent education?
When I was there, it was no longer just a private school. It was partly because the government was taking it over. So at the moment, actually, the school is a government school. Kenya High School is government. But at the time I was there, it was moving towards being a government school. So it was not as expensive as it used to be. And normally, and now I'll use the same school as an example because it's a government school, they're very good government schools. And to get into the schools, it's by grades, how well you do. And I always joke and I say, if our school was a government school at the time I went into school, when I entered, I may not have even got in. Because now it's really difficult to get into that same school because the standard for government schools, especially the good ones, is very high.
Now, what was your relationship with your biological mother, Kezia?
Yes, yes.
Did she and your father get along?
Yes.
Because you talked about his stepmother.
Yes, they did. They did. After the separation, I mean, we went to my dad, you know, my older brother and I, so there had to be some kind of communication. But I write about it in my book because the communication actually stopped for a long period between the age of, let's say, 5 until I was 13, because we used to get too upset when she came to visit. And it got too complicated because my father was in another relationship. And somehow we kind of lost touch with my mother. And I was back in touch with her when I was 13. So, you know, I didn't have that much contact with her until I was a teenager.
And that was a bit of a disappointment at the time?
You know, to be honest, you know, when you're a 4-year-old and your life sort of changes, you adapt very easily. And to me, it was almost like she was an idea. I didn't really know her. So only after I got to know her at 13 is when I started, you know, relating to her as my mom. And in many ways, our relationship is really more like a sister, older sister relationship, because we developed the relationship after I was more or less a young adult. So I didn't have the period of saying, oh, I miss my mom, because in many ways, my stepmother took on that role and we were a family. You know, we were 4 children. We had, you know, we were, life goes on. You know, you just, especially when you're little.
My guest is Auma Obama. Her memoir is called And Then Life Happens. And then your birth mother was pregnant again and your father decided to study in the United States. That's when he went to Hawaii?
He went to study. He came to America to study.
And what was he studying?
He was studying economics.
He was part of an airlift program?
He went at the same time as the airlift, but actually he was sponsored by 2 women in America who they had worked in Kenya and got to know him because he was working on a program teaching literacy. And they realized how intelligent he was, how bright he was. And they said, you should go and study. So they actually found the funds to sponsor him. And he went during the same period as the airlift was happening. And I think while he was in America, he got a little bit of assistance to buy books from the airlift, you know, organization and the group that were doing the airlift. But he definitely profited from that kind of wave of, you know, bringing in, you know, young African scholars to study in America in different universities. And he knows those are his peers. So he knows a lot of the people who went at the time, and they're very much a support system for each other.
And that's where he met Anne in Hawaii.
He met her in Hawaii. Yeah. Yes, he met her in Hawaii. They were studying. They were in the same university.
So how did your mother and Ruth react when they learned that your father wanted to get married again?
Ruth wasn't in the picture.
Oh, she was.
Ruth is his third wife.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, the second wife. I've forgotten her name now.
Anne was the second wife.
Ah.
Yeah. So it wasn't, you know. And I can't tell you how my mother reacted. I was really I was too little. I would be speculating.
Then your father did graduate work at Harvard,
mm-hmm.
and Anne didn't accompany him. When did you first meet Anne?
I met Anne as an adult when we went to one of my brother's weddings.
Mm-hmm.
So she came to the wedding, and it was really great. She's a wonderful woman. She was a wonderful woman, and we had a great time as a family.
And what was your sense of your father's relationship with her?
Well, I can't. What I know is that, for example, there was a lot of contact because My father got all the report forms, you know, for my brother, how he was doing at school. We had all the photos of him as a baby, you know, when he went into college, you know, his participation in sports. So my father was really up to date on what was going on with his son. And they were in touch, you know, he would get letters informing him. So I imagine now as an adult, it was a very amicable relationship. And they both were, you know, she was making sure he knows what's going on with his son. And he was, you know, able to get that information because they were communicating.
There are people in this country who insist that your brother was born in Kenya. Mm-hmm. How do you answer them?
You know, if you're going to try and answer every single, you know, statement that's made, be it right or wrong, you'd be so busy, you know, trying to keep up with that I really, you know, things that are on speculation or rumors, I really don't get myself involved in that. It's just too... It just takes up time and it uses up energy that I could use, you know, elsewhere in a better way.
Mm-hmm. Then your father met Ruth Baker, and you moved to Nairobi.
She came to Nairobi eventually. Oh. Yeah, mm-hmm. My father came back to Kenya.
So Ruth and your father married. You moved with them to Roseland, which is an affluent neighborhood in Nairobi. Was it odd? You were in high school with an American mother in Nairobi, Kenya. Did that cause any difficulties?
No, because I was very young. Mm-hmm. I was only 4 years old. So, you know, you go there as a child and you just kind of merge into that space. And, you know, you just kind of...
It just seems normal.
It's normal. You know, and
but
like
other
I
kids,
say,
but
the
you knew
thing,
other kids didn't have the only, a similar situation.
Well, for me, it wasn't a situation. And like I say, the only thing that may have been, and I really don't remember, is that the fact that my mom was a different skin color. And it took me a while, even as a child, to realize, oh, she doesn't look like me. So it really, you know, as a child, it's really, and that's the greatness of being, of children, the innocence of children, is that life is okay. So long as you're treated well and you're loved, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter, really.
Now, this is when you got involved with sports as well?
Sports, I've always been involved in sport when I was at school.
Because are girls encouraged to engage in sports in Kenya?
In our school system, there's always sport because part of the things about sport, it's sport that's done. It's you first of all, you have it within the curriculum. And then we always had a system that is called a house system where you belong to a particular house, you know, and it's got a name and we compete against each other. And every school trimester, because we have three semesters, you have a particular sport. So be it that it's athletics one time, or hockey, or it's you know, swimming. I was a swimmer, so it depends on what the sport is. So we always did sport. You didn't have a choice, which was, I think, great, because nowadays children are having a lot of a choice around the sport and movement and activity. And I think really, if you just get them doing it, they just get used to it, and then it's not an issue later when you're trying to go to the gym.
Well, your brother is famous for his love of basketball, playing basketball. I guess it's in the family blood. But you you started an organization, Powerful Voices. I guess that's, how do I say it?
Sauti Ku, yeah.
And that's an organization that uses sport to help kids develop?
Yes, yes.
Self-esteem and other things?
Yes.
Something that you realize sports had done for you?
Yes, definitely, because I think sport gives you an identity in many ways, in terms of you being aware of yourself as an individual and as part of a bigger whole in terms of a team. And that's something that many of the young people I work with, who are coming from the rural, the slums, the slum areas and the poor rural areas, don't have. They don't have an awareness of self. So through the sport, we try to bring that out in them, and it usually works. They gain a voice and they can, you know, be confident enough to express themselves.
Well, Kenya is a world power when it comes to running.
Yes. I know the Boston Marathon was great, wasn't it?
Well, if you're a Kenyan, yes.
Yes, yes.
Auma Obama, her memoir, And Then Life Happens, is published by St. Martin's Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Auma Obama, who has written a memoir called And Then Life Happens. It is published by St. Martin's Press, and it's translated by Ross Benjamin. Now, you didn't write this in Luo, and you didn't write it in English, which was the language that you pretty much grew up in. Why did you write it in German?
Well, the reason I wrote it in German was, one, The publisher, the initial publisher was a German publishing house, and they approached me, among others. And of all the others who approached me, and I think there were quite a few, they all wanted me to write like a kiss and tell around my family and more specifically about my brother. And I said I couldn't do that. You know, I just didn't, it wasn't what I, something I would want to do. And, you know, if they were interested, I do have a story to tell myself if they're interested in that. And this is the one publishing house that said, you know, go for it. After, of course, asking me a few questions about the content. And so that was one reason. The other reason was because I spent most of my formative years in Germany. So although I speak English very well, a lot of the experiences I had as a young adult were in German and in Germany. And in terms of even just being more conscious of myself as a young woman, this is all, I was there in the 80s when, you know the women's rights and gender equity, all of this was happening. So it was really the time when even the words to express that period of my life, they came easier in German. And also I felt that with a German audience, talking to them about it, it would be easy for them to understand what I was talking about, and it would not be so, I wouldn't have to do as much explaining, which I hope in the book is not happening as well. And at the time, it just seemed right to do it in German.
When you arrived in Germany, there must have been incredible culture shock.
There was. And, you know, some people say, oh, well, you were reading their literature, you did, you know, work around Germany to your language classes, you should have been comfortable. But to be honest, it was really different. Modern Germany was different from what I'd been reading about in my books. And it was a culture shock. The first being, I thought I could speak German after having done 2 years at high school, and I realized people didn't really understand what I was saying. So that was already a culture shock.
And you also experienced snow for the first time.
Yes, that was amazing. That was really amazing.
There is snow on Mount Kilimanjaro, but that's unless you climb
and
it.
And I'd been up Mount Kenya when I was 15, so I'd been up and seen snow. But seeing snow, like on climbing a mountain, is like, it's like, oh, this is a spectacle. But really being there and walking on it and waking up and everything is white. That was quite an experience.
And you took on the name Rita at the time?
I didn't get rid of it, but I took on my African name because I was being called Rita at school. And when I got to Germany, and I was wanting to do it anyway, when I got to Germany, I used my African name.
Oh, you went Auma. Back to Auma.
So that was also part of the coming of age in terms of identity.
Same thing happened with your brother. He was called Barry for a while, and then he became Barack again.
I don't know, but you know, I think he was always Barack, and we called him Barry. So I think he was at some point able to tell us, look, this is my name, you know, let's use it.
Now, what were your father's feelings about you studying German in Germany?
Well, I write about it in my book, and it's quite interesting because I actually left. I got a scholarship to study at the University of Heidelberg, and I left without telling my father because I was worried, because he was quite a dominant character, and I was worried that he might, being the only girl, he might refuse me to go and study abroad. So I got the scholarship without telling him, and he was very shocked. And he was an economist. He was, you know, but he said you had to do something practical. So initially when he found out it was German, he was like, okay, you're studying German, but you know that anybody can speak German, even the homeless person under the bridge can speak German. So what happens after learning the language? So as far as he's concerned, for him, it was just a step towards going where I want to go.
And where did you want to go? What did you think you were going to do with it?
You know, at that time, I didn't know. And that's the interesting thing. And I always say this to young people because I studied for the love of studying. I was really a true scholar in terms of enjoying just studying for the sake of it. And it was many years later that I started realizing, wait a minute, I've got to earn a living doing this. And I didn't think too much about it. So ultimately what would have happened is I would have become a lecturer in a university doing German language and literature, eventually linguistics. But luckily I was able to, you know, find my niche in the work that I do now. But at the time, I was just enjoying being a student and gaining the knowledge.
And falling in love.
That too. I was in Heidelberg. And in Heidelberg, there's a song that goes, I lost my heart in Heidelberg. So I did that too.
And then in 1982, your father died in a tragic accident. There were police investigations. What did they discover?
I wasn't there, so I really don't know. And actually, even talking about it, the passage in my book, I just talk about, I have a conversation with my aunt who tries to explain to me the circumstances around his death and what her opinion is on it. But I wasn't there. I was in Germany.
Well, there were people who felt there was a political implication. Your father had expressed criticism of Daniel Arap Moi's government.
It would be speculation on my part. I really just have the conversation that I had with my aunt. Yeah.
Well, after he died, didn't another woman marry him?
No.
I thought there was a post.
No, what happened is once my father died, because there was a child involved in his relationship with his partner, there were some rituals that had to happen in order for her to be able to come to the funeral. Because in the Luo culture, funerals are quite a big thing. And in order for her to be able to come to the funeral and her family and her relatives, there had to be a ritual to recognize her as having been with my father and being the mother of a child that's an Obama. Mm-hmm. So it's a more ritual around the possibility of her being part of our family.
My guest is Auma Obama. Her memoir, And Then Life Happens, is published by St. Martin's Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And then one day you received a letter from your brother, Barack Barry Obama. What did it say?
It was from Barack Obama, not from Barry.
Oh, it was just from Barack.
It was Barack Obama, yeah. He just wanted to know who I was, introduced himself, because unfortunately even the opening towards us getting to know each other was because my father had passed away, and he that way got contacted to let him know. And he then wrote to me, and, you know, we started corresponding, and eventually we agreed to meet, and I came to Chicago and met him.
And he obviously wanted to learn more about your father and also know who his relatives were. Mm-hmm. So you went to Chicago. How much of the story were you able to tell him?
Well, as
and
much
how much
as
did
it,
he know?
I managed to tell him as much as it takes 10 days to talk and spend time together in between him going to work.
Now you can give him the book.
Yes, now. He has it all already. He knows what's in the book. So it was, you know, it was a very intense time. We spent only 10 days together. And really, we used that time to basically catch up. He had bits of information here and there. I had bits of information about him. And we just took, you know, we consolidated all of that information in that time to really get to know each other better and also give him a feel for who we were as family. That was important to me.
What was he doing in Chicago at the time?
He was working as a community organizer in Chicago at the time.
Mm-hmm. And you say you left with a heavy heart. Did
yeah.
you? Were you attracted to the thought of perhaps moving to a place like Chicago?
No. I left Barack with a heavy heart because it was just 10 days. It was a very short time. And the interesting thing about it was that I was in America in total for a month. And I have a very good friend, Elke, who also features in the book, a close, close friend. She, at the time, she was on a Fulbright scholarship in Illinois, in Carbondale. And I actually organized my trip so that I'd spend time with her. And then in between, I would be with Barack and I would go back to her because I was worried if I don't like him, I'll be so disappointed that I can go back and spend time with Elke before I go back to Germany. And it was really sad because, you know, I kind of gave that period so little time because I was worried that we wouldn't get along. But we got on so well that I just didn't want it to end.
And then you went back to Germany. You fell in love.
I went back to Germany, yes.
And that created more difficulties. Why were there problems with your relationship with Carl?
No. It didn't create difficulties. It was just really, you know, it's different cultures. It wasn't so much difficulties in that when I'm writing the book, I try to analyze how the relationship was. Me as a black girl, Carl as a German, and then his family getting to know about us and me being introduced to that family, how they react to the family. And I think
what I meant as difficulties.
Well, it's just kind of normal things that happen in a multicultural relationship where really it's so new. And actually, it's interesting because that's part of what I studied at the university. It's all about, you know, what is foreign, what is different, how do you relate to differences? And often it's governed by fear, and it's fear because you don't know it. It's so foreign to what you know. And that I experienced in my relationship because, you know, we were in love. For us, it was okay. But for the rest of the family, it was not so easy.
So you went with him to Kenya?
He came to visit. Yeah, he came to Kenya to visit.
And then you took an ill-fated car trip. What happened?
Ill-fated is maybe saying too much. At that time, we didn't think it was ill-fated. We drove in my little Beetle, which was a car that was already at that time probably 12 years old, up to Lake Turkana, which is up north. And for people who know Kenya, I mean, that's quite a distance. It takes the whole day to drive up.
And that's largely...
And it broke down.
That's largely a desert area,
yeah,
except for the lake.
But
it's where...
Yeah.
That's where many people think humans actually began.
Yeah, it was beautiful. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. And we didn't have any money as well. Well, not much, enough for petrol. And we camped out just at the lake, you know, and in the reeds. And I sometimes think, oh, my God, who knows? Maybe there were crocodiles. But, you know, at that age, you don't worry about it. You just do. And we were lucky to get back. You know, it was okay.
And then you and Barack, correspondent, and he came to Kenya.
He did. He came to Kenya.
And he met the rest of the family.
He did. It was great. It was very busy. We have a lot of relatives.
Now, then Michelle and Barack came a second time, and we almost lost a future president during that trip.
Oh, not really. Come on. That was the same beetle again. Are you talking about the time when it started to smoke and I thought there was a fire in the engine? Is that the time you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it was okay. We did okay. And actually, because funnily enough, we have a lot of these kind of like, we would probably call it in America, I don't know, backyard garages and mechanics. We broke down on a major highway in Nairobi, and suddenly two guys came and they were with their tools and ready to fix it. And we're like, okay. So they fixed the car and we were fine. We got a bit of a scare.
Were you surprised that he rose so quickly in the American political system? You went to Washington when he became senator.
Yes.
And then again when he was running for president. And suddenly you were a celebrity as well. The paparazzi were following you everywhere.
That was scary. And I think, luckily for me, I think there were just two incidents. But it was really quite scary because it brought it home to me that, you know, okay, this is big. Because although I was there when he became senator, and then also going... And this happened actually before he became president. So it was during just when the campaign was kicking off. And it was a little bit scary because I, you know, with the homes in England, you can just walk up to the front door. And having this situation was really, really scary.
You were living in England.
I was living in England at the time. But like I said, it only happened twice. And afterwards, you know, I didn't have a problem. But it was big. It did make, you know, a bit of a difference. It did put me, it gave me a visibility that I had to learn how to cope with, in order not to be overwhelmed by it.
So are you welcome at the White House? Can you say, I'm coming by for a little visit?
Okay, let's put it this way. It's my brother's home. So when I visit my brother, I visit him at home.
And thank you so much for visiting us in our home here.
Thank you for having me. Thank
you. Oma Obama's memoir is called And Then Life Happens. It's published by St. Martin's Press. It's been a pleasure talking with you. And were you going back to where, England now, or
no, I have a few more stops before I leave America. So,
but where are you living these days?
I live in Kenya. I'm based in Kenya, and the work I'm doing is also based in Kenya. So, yeah.
Thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for a great conversation.